Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called Inward Journey. It is the second selection in the series entitled Inward Journey East and West. And now, Joseph Campbell.
Some 3 or 4 years ago, I was invited to deliver a series of lectures at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, on schizophrenia. By the way, when you phone Big Sur from New York, the New York telephone operator says, Big Sewer. I had lectured there the year before on mythology, and apparently Mr. Michael Murphy, the director, thought there was some connection. But since I didn't know anything at all about schizophrenia, I phoned and said, Mike, I don't know anything about schizophrenia. How would it be if I lectured on James Joyce? And he said, that'd be fine. But he said, I'd like you to lecture on schizophrenia just the same. And so I'm going to arrange for you and Dr. John Perry of San Francisco to give a dual talk, the two together, on schizophrenia. Well, in my youth, I had the great good fortune to kiss the Blarney Stone, which is worth 7 PhDs. And so I thought, okay, why not? Then Dr. Perry sent me a copy of a paper that he had written on schizophrenia. It had been published in 1963 in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences. And to my great amazement, I found that the imagery of the schizophrenic paralleled almost point for point the themes that I had rendered in The Hero with a Thousand Faces back in 1949, which was based simply on a comparative study of mythology. It had nothing to do with psychoanalysis or psychology, but it was simply a synthesis of the materials and imageries of the mythological traditions of mankind, delineating the main constant motifs that did appear in all. These are universal archetypal themes in the mythologies of mankind. And from this paper of Dr. Perry, I discover that they are produced spontaneously from the broken-off condition of a complete schizophrenia, complete psychosis, a person who has lost touch entirely with the context of his society and is functioning out of his own base. Very briefly, the main pattern is one of cutoff or departure from the local social order, a retreat inward, backward in time, as it were, and inward into the psyche, an encounter, a series of terrifying experiences, and finally, if fortunate, encounters of a symbolic kind that center, harmonize, give new courage to the individual, and then a return journey. This is the pattern of the myth. This is the pattern that came up in these images of the psyche. Now, it was Dr. Perry's thesis that in certain kinds of schizophrenia, the best thing is to let the process continue, not to abort the psychosis, not to perform any psychiatric operations such as shock treatment or anything of the kind that will abort the psychosis, but to help the person along. In order to be helpful, however, the doctor has to understand the imagery of mythology. He has to understand what these signs and signals are that this person, totally out of contact with the rationally oriented individual is trying to bring forth in order to establish a contact. A psychosis, from this point of view, is an effort to recover and restore a lost balance. And let the person go. He has tipped over, but help him through. Well, while I was out there, I had some very exciting, for me, conversations with Dr. Perry, and our dual statement, the talk we gave together, was for me a very great experience. And it started me thinking more and more about the immediate import of this material, which I had been dealing with in a more or less scholarly, academic, personally enthusiastic way, but without any sense of its possible import for people in trouble today. Then Dr. Perry and Mr. Murphy gave me a paper by a Dr. Julian Silverman, which had appeared in the American Anthropologist in 1967, on schizophrenia and shamanism. And there I found something very interesting again. Because, of course, when one studies primitive mythologies, the imagery of the mythological world derives from the psychological experiences of the shamans. The source of the imagery of primitive myths is the shaman's psychological crisis. The shaman is a person who, in his early puberty, has cracked off, broken off, and gone into what we would today call a psychosis. Another shaman is sent for, a mature shaman is sent for, to help him through this. And by interpreting the gestures and so forth of the young psychotic, he brings him out of it. Now let me just tell you the story of one shaman situation that is described by Rasmussen, the great Danish explorer who in the early 1920s went across the north of North America, a man of great human sympathy and understanding, who was able to talk with the shamans whom he encountered in northern Canada and so forth along the Arctic Circle, very simple societies, and understand and appreciate their experiences and what they had undergone. And there was one man who told him of what had happened to him. When this shaking and retreat from the world came on, his parents knew that the best thing to do was to send for a shaman to help him through this. And this shaman, according to this account, put him on a sled and took him out onto the wastes of snow, built a tiny little igloo, hardly big enough to contain him, lifted him from the sled onto a skin in the igloo, and left him there for 30 days. And brought him every 10 days some tiny little bit of food and water. And he said, I died many times during that time. But there came to me experiences that one can come to only in solitude and in silence. Another shaman whom Rasmussen met in Alaska told him of a similar adventure into the silence. Now this shaman was in trouble with his community. Shamans have a very dangerous job, because if anything goes wrong anywhere, people blame it on the shaman. They think he's working magic. Anyone who has powers that other people don't have is likely to be an object of jealousy and you know, suspicion. And so this old fellow had invented a number of trick devices and mythological scare theses to frighten people and keep them at bay. Rasmussen knew that this was all fakery. And he said to the old man, isn't there anything you believe? Isn't there anything that is honest and sincere in your life? Oh, yes, he says, but I have to protect myself with this hocus-pocus. But he said, I'll tell you what is true. I've heard the voice of the universe. And it is gentle, and it is kind, and it is like a mother speaking. Or it is like the fall of snow, or it is like children laughing and playing. And what it says is, do not be afraid of the universe. He had had the kind of experience that one hears of from the great mystics. These are very simple men. Now, Silverman, in his article, has found analogies with certain kinds of schizophrenia. It was from this article that I learned that there are two quite different orders of schizophrenia. One he calls essential schizophrenia, and the other he calls paranoid schizophrenia. Now, with essential schizophrenia, you are approaching the shamanistic attitude and crisis. It is one of withdrawal from the impact of experience in the world. This happens spontaneously. There is a narrowing of concern and focus. The object world falls away, and invasions of the unconscious content overtake and overwhelm one. This he calls essential schizophrenia. Paranoid schizophrenia is just the opposite. The person remains extremely sensitive to the environment, but interpreting it all in terms of his own projections. That is to say, his own terrors, his own fears, his own sense of being assaulted from inside, he projects outward and he thinks the world is assailing him. This is not the one that leads to the kind of inward experience. This leads to a person being a kind of lunatic in the outer world. The other is a very pitiful thing to observe, a person who is fighting these terrible struggles with the psychological energies within. Now, what is the difference between the essential schizophrenia and the case of the shaman? The difference is this. The shaman does not reject the social order and its forms. It is actually through them that he comes back and he reinforces them. His symbology is at one with the symbology of his culture, or, on the other hand, it comes back to re-inform the culture world when he has returned from the crisis. Whereas in the psychosis, there is a break-off and there is no communication with the symbol system of the culture. The symbol system of the culture is not helping in the psychosis. The shaman, there is an accord. Well, then, in New York, this all came in a quick series in my experience. A psychiatrist in New York, Dr. Mortimer Ostow, invited me to be discussant to a paper that he read before a Society for Adolescent Psychiatry here in New York, in which he was dealing with the LSD, psychosis, mysticism, and what he called antinomianism, well, that is to say the anti-social attitudes, which are rather frequently advertised in the papers and TVs today as associated with our youth. Well, this was an extremely interesting affair, because here a whole new phalanx of thought came in, all in association with these same themes. Now, what turned out here was that, as I've analyzed it since and discussed it with Dr. Ostow, the LSD retreat inward relates somewhat to the essential schizophrenia situation. The antinomianism, as he calls it, is more like the paranoid schizophrenia. That is to say, a sense of threat from outside, and the society or the establishment is absolutely, you know, there's a break, there's no communication with it and all that, and it is only interpreted only in negative terms and not in terms of any understanding of what it's really about. So that you have, you might say, a lunatic asylum without walls. People are out in the street that ought to be in the bunkhouse. But this is a kind of violent, outwardly directed action. The LSD thing is fascinating in relation to this. It is a intentionally achieved schizophrenia, so to say, with the hope and expectation for a spontaneous remission, which doesn't always occur. Yoga is also an intentional schizophrenia. One breaks off, turns inward, and the mystic process as well is very similar. Now, what's the difference between the mystical and the psychotic experience? They plunge into the same waters, there's no doubt about it. The symbolism is just the same. And I want to speak about it in a little while, what it is. The difference is that the mystic, with the instruction of a master, or because of his own native talents, is able to swim in those waters. He does not drown in them. Whereas the schizophrenic has gone in and has drowned. Can he be drawn up? They are the same waters. Now let's ask ourselves, what are those waters? They are the waters, as I say, that are imaged in the universal archetypes of mythology. And I've been working on this all my life, and I can tell you there are these universal images. They are the same all over the world. They are interpreted differently in the different traditions. They are given different emphases, different rational applications, different social concerns to support. But the images are the same. And they come in the same relationships to each other. What do these represent? These are the images that in the psychology of Jung are called the archetypes of the collective unconscious. Now, what he means by the collective unconscious is those powers that derive from the biological instinct system of man. All animals operate instinctively, as well as in terms of relationship to the immediate circumstances of their activities. They are impelled by powers which they did not think out, but which really govern their lives. So is man so governed. It is these powers that manifest themselves through these archetypes. Now, with respect to animals, I remember having seen a very interesting nature film, I think it was one of the Disney films, of a turtle laying her eggs in the sand about 30 yards from the water. And some days later, out of the sand, and the camera was there, come these tiny little just-born turtles, about as big as nickels. And they, without a quarter of a second hesitation, started right for the ocean. They didn't hunt around and say, now what would be a reasonable place for me to go now? Nor did they make any mistakes and first go fumbling into the bushes and then say, oh, and then turn around. I'm meant for something better than this. They went like that. And meanwhile, the seagulls said, boy, there they are. And these dive bombers started coming down on these tiny little nickels that were trying to get to the ocean. And these little fellows knew darn well that that's where they had to get. And they went as fast as their little legs. And the legs knew what to do. They knew that their eyes were meant to go, to show them where to go. The whole thing was in perfect operation, with a whole little fleet of little tanks going for the water. Well, now you'd think that for these little turtles, these terrific breaking waves would be terrifying, and those silly gulls up there, not frightening at all. On the contrary, they went right into the water, and they knew how to swim. Meanwhile, of course, the fish start at them. Life's tough. I mean, people talk about going back to nature. They don't really know what they're doing. Now, this whole system was exactly there. There have been some very interesting experiments that I've mentioned, I think, here before, made on little chickens that just hatched from the egg in a little chicken coop. If a hawk flies over the nest, those little things run for protection. If a pigeon flies over, they're not concerned at all. Where did they learn this? Who's acting when a little thing says, oh, here he comes, I go? And psychologists have made little imitation hawks out of wood and drawn them across the coop on a wire. The little things run for shelter. If the same hawk is drawn backwards, they don't move. Now, these are called innate releasing mechanisms. And this stimulus sets going a system of action which is built into the central nervous system. There are such in man as well. And this is what is meant by instinct. The complication of instinct. If you will read, for example, some of the life histories of parasites, you won't believe it. Read the life course of a hydrophobia parasite, and you won't think that a human being is worthy to be host to such a genius. But they know what to do, where to go, and how to set people mad. Now, in the human being, we have an instinct system, and it is pushing us. But we have also a culture system. Now, the peculiar thing about man that distinguishes him from all other animals is that he's born 12 years too soon. No mother would wish that it should not be so. But nevertheless, there are these 12 years of utter dependency that the child is committed to. It is during those 10 years or 12 that the child is turned into a human being. It learns to walk as its people walk. It learns to speak, to think, to cogitate in the vocabulary of that local language. It learns to respond with enthusiasm to certain signals and with fear to others, which are not natural but are socially oriented and socially functioning signals. A mythology is the context of nature and culture signals in such a close amalgam that you can hardly distinguish them from each other. And they work on the psyche as naturally and spontaneously as the stimuli of nature on an animal. A functioning mythological symbol is an energy-evoking and directing sign. It does not have to pass through the brain and be interpreted there. It works like that. The brain, however, may interfere and short-circuit it. And when that happens, the signals are not functioning. Or one may become conditioned to a system of signals which are present only in a very small portion of the environment. For instance, people who are brought up in quite special sects who do not participate in the culture forms of the rest of the environment, they can never learn to participate in the culture except in its small dimension, the small dimension of their local family, and so forth. That person is disoriented in the larger world altogether. There's a very important problem families face. To know that the signals that they are imprinting on their children are signals that are not going to alienate them from the world in which those children are going to live. They have to be in accord with at least the progressive, decent aspects of the world into which they're coming.